Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
F-A me, no, F-A-U. That's so funny. Only real upset is a 16 versus a 1. Rock chalk, gluck. This is the Cigna read. Arizona, I'll take a box of that. Higher seeds do wear white. Oral Roxanne Roberts. San Fran Lebowitz's kiln. Marquette the bed. Marquette the bed. I stand in the pool, 42 long shot. Creighton Barrel Curio Cabinet. And who is Tony? These are brilliant.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
I think Marquette the Bed was Bill Isaacson.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that was him. Well, yeah, and they did.
They did.
And they did.
Yeah,
they
went out in the
second
merit.
Round. I can't tell you tremendous amounts about the games last night because I only watched 2.5 of them. On PTI, if anybody watches PTI, I basically picked 4 upsets. I said that the lower-seeded teams, not the number lower, but lower-seeded in terms of regard, all 4 could win. And I did say Florida Atlantic could win, and what I said about Florida Atlantic was 2 things. One, they've won 33 games this year, the most in the country. Well, now it's 34. And I felt it would be hard for Tennessee to get up for them after beating Duke, which to me is a signature win.
Absolutely.
I mean, you recruit on beating Duke. You don't recruit on beating FAU.
Yeah, but you thought beating Duke would give you the blueprint to get out of that bracket, which became a lot easier.
And I concede that. I just didn't think that psychologically that the players at Tennessee, highly recruited players, were going to be able to consider FAU a legitimate threat to them. And FAU beat them. And so now as a 9 seed, they're into the Elite Eight, which isn't supposed to happen. Good for them. Probably get a lot more people going to school in Boca Raton. Just be careful because people my age are walking in the streets in Boca Raton.
Get head Don't, south and head, take a dinner out at Gibby's.
Yeah, try not to run us over. Yeah, there's a lot of takeout at Gibby's, although a lot of it stays there because people go to takeout and forget why they're there. I thought Michigan State was going to win. I did. Yeah, that was a great game.
It really was.
That kid, the 5'8 guard, he's great. Jay Billis said on the PTI show yesterday, you've got to let him take those shots because when he goes up in the air, he is looking to pass. Don't let him pass, make him take the shot. And they didn't make him take the shot most of the time. But he played a great game. Yeah, he just set the career record for assists. And that was a fabulous game to watch, honestly. Went into overtime. It was really fabulous.
Very cool to see the way coaches work with the timeouts and the way you set up that pass.
Izzo knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and the sad thing about Michigan State, they didn't get a shot off. They're down 3, and they didn't get a shot off. Yeah. So that was no good. The Arkansas game was disappointing to me. Arkansas was out of it early. Yeah. I guess UConn's better than I thought. And I did not stay up for Gonzaga-UCLA. I thought Gonzaga would win. There's a lot of 3s that have kept going. A lot of 3s have moved on. I don't know about 2s, and there's 2 1s left, and you'll see them tonight. And they are the 2 best ones, Alabama and Houston. Purdue was not the best one. And Kansas was not the – Kansas had like 5-6 losses the whole year. That's
see,
all I can
I thought you were going to go back to the 3s at the end of the UCLA game, how easy those looked.
I didn't see the UCLA.
Oh, you didn't see the highlight yet?
No.
They just go back and forth, and they're taking the
I know a kid
first
made a 3.
Deep.
A kid made a 3 to end the game, and nobody expected him to be shooting. And he didn't shoot with like 1 second left. He just
in like 12
got,
seconds.
Got the ball, threw it up, and it went in. Yeah. So anyway, I'm telling you this. I'm looking at these for the first time. These are responses to the Willis Reed eulogy. That's probably the best word I could use. I am reluctant to read these things just because I don't want it to sound self-indulgent. But I'm just going to go through them, and we'll see. If it gets bad, just tell me to stop. This from DG. I saw your segment on ESPN about Willis Reed. He was sent to me by DG from his friend. My name is Richard Katz, best friend of DG. He said I should share my story about Willis. I, like you, first met him when I was at camp. Peter Barron, who listens to the show all the time and is the archivist of Camp Kiyuma, sent me pictures of Willis Reed at camp. So he was there. I knew he was there.
That's fantastic.
But I was not absolutely certain, and he was there a few times. I, like you, first met him when I was at camp. I'd been to my sister's engagement party, and my camp trunk was filled with food. Willis took a nap in my bunk, and when he saw the food, he called me Supermarket. Since my father, that's a great name. Since my father had season tickets, he would take me to home games where I would go behind the basket and Willis would always come over and give me a hug. Fast forward to around 73, 74, I was in medical school in Oklahoma where Willis went for knee surgery. Hadn't seen him for a long time, probably his last game at the Garden, so I went to his room where he was in traction and sleeping. I walked into the room, he opened his eyes, saw me and said, Supermarket. That's unbelievable.
Isn't that great?
One very special moment with a very special man. From Shad, straight, no chaser, condolences. From David Alexander in Portland, Oregon, thanks for the memories of Willis Reed. May 8th, 1970 was my 18th birthday and my high school senior prom. I'd like to find my prom date today and apologize to her for picking her up late that night just so I could watch the captain come out onto the court. Two jump shots and the game was over. Here's hoping we don't have to wait another 50 years for the next championship. Maybe 60. Oh, that's great. Yeah, the left two left-handed jump shots. He didn't score again. Dan Kelly, Bradford, Pennsylvania. I was not old enough to remember the 70 Knicks and very vague memories of the 73 team, but my dad recounted those years to me so many times and with such passion, I feel like I did experience it. Hearing you talk about those years brought me back to my dad and how he would rhapsodize about those Knicks teams. He would always laugh at the modern-day game when each team has six assistant coaches. As you know, Red had no assistants. He had Jimmy Wurgles and he had Danny Whalen, the trainer. He had the PR guy and the trainer sitting on the bench. As you know, Red had no assistants, just Danny Whalen, the trainer, sitting next to him. We had one other guy, Jimmy Wurgles. And Red Holzman led five of the most talented players to ever share the ball. Phil Jackson was right. He would always mention Eddie Donovan, too, who I think drafted Willis and traded for Dave DeBuscher. Thanks so much sharing about the Knicks and letting me hear my dad again through your voice, Dan Kelly in Bradford, Pennsylvania. From John McCartney in Chicago, I write to thank you for the thoughtful, respectful, and pitch-perfect eulogizing of Willis Reed on Wednesday's show. We all enjoy Garcia's zany humor, the one-in-a-million counter stories, true or fanciful, Jesse's digestive challenges, good tips on Oregon wines, and the mystery of Carville's lexicon. However, I believe many of us littles, especially those who are generationally advanced, most enjoy and appreciate the show when you, addressing a topic of importance or solemnity, don that virtual Doctor of Humane Letters jacket and deliver exactly the right words with exactly the right tone and exactly the right construction. Dignified, so right. A giant of a man, quiet, gentle, except on the court, straightforward, and always seemingly in control, with an understanding of self. Always Reed DeBuscher, never DeBuscher Reed or Frazier Reed, spot on, the leader. Never a question from the moment the team came together who the leader was. In ballet, the description of Nick's style of play, I would add, respected. 10-year career, five times first or second team All-NBA in a period when he overlapped with Russell, Chamberlain, Abdul-Jabbar, Wes Unseld, and Dave Cowens, and Bob Lanier, by the way. A native New Yorker of similar age, I too was at the Garden that night. The ticket, if memory serves, an early high school graduation present from my parents, purchased from a friend by my dad the moment he heard that Willis Reed would be unable to play game six in L.A. I don't remember my seat number or section, but I clearly remember I was high enough up and at just the right angle to see down the tunnel leading to the Knicks locker room across the court. Thus, I had a few seconds head start in recognizing that Reed was walking down the tunnel in his white Knick warm-ups and not street clothes. I agree. The roar as he emerged was the loudest I've ever heard in an arena. As you may know, in the long history and multiple incarnations of Madison Square Garden, basketball mecca of the world, scene of heavyweight championship fights, concerts, festivals, and great events of all sorts, that single moment, not even an athletic activity, merely a proud man walking simply onto the court to help Willis' team to a long-awaited championship, was voted the greatest moment in Madison Square Garden history. I didn't know that.
Oh, really? I didn't know that either.
And the vote is correct, RIP captain. That's very, very nice from John McCartney. I got a note from Melman about how great a player Frazier was. Frazier was a great player. He said, don't give short shrift to Frazier. Not giving short shrift to Frazier. When you have a basketball team, there is somebody who leads that team. There is somebody who is depended upon to be the leader, the captain, the glue, the person who stands at the top of the bridge and directs the ship. And that's what Willis Reed was. There were great players all around him. Bill Bradley is one of the greatest players to ever play in college. His Princeton story is unbelievable. There's a book about Bill Bradley called A Sense of Where You Are, written by an English professor at Princeton University, John McPhee, no longer with us, I don't think. It's a totally brilliant book. I did a big story for the Washington Post about Bill Bradley. I revere Bill Bradley. Okay, Dick Barnett, one of the great shooters of all time. Just a fabulous spot-up jump shooter. Dave DeBuscher, as I said before, two-sport athlete, pitched in the major leagues and played baseball. And Walt Frazier. The Walt Frazier game in the finals is almost as good, if not as good, as the Magic Johnson game in the finals. These are the greatest finals games of all time. And I will sit here forever and ever and ever while there's breath in me and tell you that Willis Reed was the most important player and the best player for that team. For that team. And again, it was always Reed and. It was never and Reed. Mark Shepard, Rockville, Maryland. As a native Detroiter, I always rooted against all New York teams with one exception. When the Pistons traded DeBuscher to the Knicks for Walt Bellamy and Howie Komarz, Butch Komarz. Still one of the worst trades in NBA history, it is. I had to root for that Knicks team. DeBuscher went to UD High and University of Detroit College, and he could flat out play. While your comments were spot on, as usual, about Willis and the 70 Knicks, there's one significant omission. First man off the bench, Cazzie Russell. That's right. Cazzie Russell, like a three-time All-American in Michigan. Cazzie Russell and Bill Bradley were two of the greatest college players to ever live. And like Willis, a class act. Like those fans who weren't there at the game, I had a tear in my eye when Willis limped out of that tunnel. One of the great scenes in sports history. I had no idea that, in fact, there was a vote like that. But that is a great vote.
Isn't it?
And by the way, just to remind you people, Ali Frazier won, I think, was in the Garden.
Yes, I think you're right.
Ali Frazier won, which a lot of people think is the greatest fight of all time.
Let me check that.
You know, I think that was in the Garden, I think. From Gary Sims, I was heartbroken to learn of the death of Willis Reed. You mentioned on PTI last night. That's so it was a couple of days ago. He played at your camp, Cuma, I believe. He also played at my camp, Echo Lark. Sure, on the other side of the lake. Echo Lark. He stayed overnight at a guest house. That evening, he joined us at the canteen. For those younger than 50, that was where the older kids got together for sodas and ice cream. He's a great storyteller, very approachable. When we told him about an 8-year-old camper who was a real pain in the rear, he got up and walked to the kid's bunk when he was fast asleep. Willis reached down, picked him up, pinned him to the bunk ceiling. He then said, "I am the devil." The kid did exactly what you would expect. Willis laughed as we helped him dry off. A memory forever. Fantastic. So I wanted to do that. And you know.
You are correct, by the way. The Ali Frazier.
Ali Frazier won.
Yeah.
That's at Madison the Garden.
Street. Yeah.
Come on now.
It's at the Garden.
You know, been some great concerts at the Garden.
Sure.
You know, I
wasn't the band the final, you know, whatever the last
one. I don't know. I don't know. But I mean, there've been an enormous amount of great things. So I'll read this one more thing from John Lohman in Charlottesville, Virginia. And this is about America.
Sorry, Winterland Ballroom, San Francisco. Okay. I couldn't have been more wrong.
This is about the song America. Paul Simon, when he walked off to look for America. Kathy, I'm lost, that I said as I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching, and I don't know why. Oh. Dear Tony, I discovered your podcast about 6 months ago and have been a dedicated listener ever since. Among the many things I enjoy about your show is the musical elements you integrate into the program, be it the brilliant parodies by Dan Byrne and others, your generous exposure of countless deserving and often unrecognized songwriters, and last but not least, your uncannily accurate recitations of lyrics from classic songs of your youth that have made invaluable contributions to the American songbook. Regarding the latter, I really appreciated your recitation on the opening verse of Paul Simon's America, which I agree is one of the greatest songs penned by one of the greatest songwriters of his generation. He won the first Gershwin Prize. The first prize in the United States of America ever given to composing songs, popular musical songs, went to Paul Simon. I believe we went to that when there was a celebration. Did you come with me to that? We saw Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel sing together. It's the last time it ever happened, right? I mean, it was fabulous. Doing backup for these songs, just standing there doing backup all night. Hello, Jackson Brown and Bonnie Raitt. Right? They're doing backup.
Yeah, these kids are all right.
As a folklorist, John Lohman writes, I've been blessed with the opportunity to interview many great songwriters, a craft that never ceases to impress me. While when analyzing great songs, we almost often understandably focus on their lyrics and melodic composition, what is often overlooked are songs' more subtle atmospheric elements. For me, what truly distinguishes song, what lifts it from the status of a great song, that one is iconic and timeless classic, are two of the repeated measures of melancholic humming that open it. Hummed in Simon and Garfunkel's signature harmony, it sets the mood perfectly, instantly transporting the listener into that complex and paradoxical combination of boundless optimism and desperate longing that often inhabits the young. Wow, that's good writing. For me, by the end of those two simple hum measures, I've always felt like I intimately knew the narrator already before he sings a single word. There are people in rock and roll who have that gift naturally. The Bee Gees are three brothers, Barry, Maurice, and Robin Gibb. The Beach Boys are three brothers and a cousin, Brian, Carl, Dennis Wilson, and Mike Love. That comes genetically for them. Paul Simon and Artie Garfunkel don't have that. Art Garfunkel, if you have never done this, just listen to Art Garfunkel sing by himself sometimes. He's the best. Yes. He's the best. That's why Bridge Over Troubled Water is just, it's the best.
Yeah.
They both sing. And then Artie takes it home. I mean, come on. Come on. You mentioned, John Lohman writes, after your recitation, you once wrote a paper about this song, and I'm so curious about what he had to say about it. Who knows? So long. Being that it's nearly impossible for me to recover papers, I've even written from my graduate work in the 90s. I'm guessing your paper lives at best as a hard copy, or maybe you no longer have a copy at all. In lieu of a proper reading, turning your podcast into an academic conference, sure to turn off even your most sympathetic readers. Do you care to give us at least the cliff notes on your thesis? It was terrible. I was an English major. I had an hour left before a paper was due. And I just thought I could, you know, I could be cooler than everybody else and write about a song. I was stupid.
You were playing cards all night.
Gin. I was stupid. Don't take me as an example. I got lucky. Just as importantly, having learned through a Google search that they came from a small family-run bakery, first in New Jersey and later in Brooklyn. Have you ever tried a Mrs. Wagner's pie? Oh, of course. Oh, of course. They were wrapped up. They were in every grocery store in New York, Mrs. Wagner's pies. They were round, little, single-person pies.
Did not know that. Never
had
one of those.
They're not big pies.
Do they still exist?
I doubt that. I don't even exist. Thanks for all you do, and be careful. His bow tie is really a camera. Appreciate that very much. We'll take a break. Who's first?
Barry's Veluga.
Barry's Veluga. When we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is Cindy Cruz. We have played her work before. Her dad sent a song called May last month, and she sent the MP3 for two other songs that she has out, original composition lyrics. This is called Know You. This was released earlier this month. On the 10th of the month.
Yeah.
Now, how do you get a job? You know, what are you doing? Well, I'm working at the Giant, but I can sing.
It's amazing.
Just unbelievable.
It's amazing.
They're all so good. We'll play another song by Cindy Cruz later, and at the end of the podcast, just listen on your own. She plays in Barry's Veluga. I'm going to start local because I think that while this is a local story, it has potentially national implications. The Ed Cooley hire. Ed Cooley, who was born and raised in Providence, Rhode Island, and upon signing a long-term contract, says what everybody says. This is my dream job. I'll never leave. I love it here. You're all my friends and family. And then leaves. To take what would have been a better job, other than the fact that in the last 5 years, Patrick Ewing couldn't have sunk the program any lower. I mean, it's at the bottom of the sea right now. It's not a great job now, but it could be. What do you think of that hire?
I think it's a good hire. I think it answers some of the questions that you had no idea about Patrick Ewing when he came in, the greatest player in program history. The only, John Thompson, for all his greatness, never went to the Final Four without Patrick Ewing as his center.
One championship.
But you had no idea whether Patrick Ewing could recruit a class, whether Patrick Ewing could draw up a play, whether Patrick Ewing could build a program. And 6 years later, the answer was emphatically he could not. You know all those things about Ed Cooley, and you can pick apart his record at Providence. Georgetown will play up the fact that he made seven of the most recent nine NCAA tournaments and reached a Sweet 16 and won a Big East regular season championship. The naysayers would say, well, two of those NCAA tournaments, he got to the first four and lost. He only won games in two of the seven tournaments that he reached. So you can pick it apart. But in terms of what's a better job, Tony, Providence has had notable success going back to the 70s and certainly the 87 team coached by Rick Pitino with Billy Donovan as the point guard. But it's never been a national brand.
That's
like
right.
Georgetown has.
That's right.
And is that brand hollow at the moment? Do kids grow up wanting to be Alonzo Mourning or Allen Iverson? I don't think so. But there's a way to restore it to a height that I don't think is ever attainable at Providence. So
okay.
There's a lot of work to do. Ed Cooley is not just a no-brainer success, but I think it's a very, very solid hire and gives them a chance to, instead of just being DePaul for the rest of time, build themselves back up into someone that can contend pretty regularly in a very fun Big East conference.
A lot of people, when they coach at a new school and they have an introductory press conference, say, we're going to be good. We're going to make the tournament. We're going to make you proud. Ed Cooley said we're going to win a national championship. That sets the bar pretty high, Barry.
Yeah, it seems like bluster. I will say these things are so awkward, Tony, because they're like part pep rally and part press conference. Like, right. They should have two separate events. It's, you know, they play the fight song and there are cheerleaders there, but the first few rows are reserved for nerds like me asking questions. So he really used it as a let's get everybody together behind this thing. I'm going to be on campus. I want to meet every student there. And it was almost like, he made a point of saying, I don't speak using notes, and it gets to be a runaway train. Like, why shouldn't they've won a national championship here? Why shouldn't I say that's what we're going to do? It definitely, you know, as I wrote, like, he won the day, and that's step one. There's a lot of days ahead with a lot of work. A national title from back-to-back Big East seasons in which your conference record is 2-37 is a long way off.
I'll just say this. What is most notable about the Georgetown program right now, and Ed Cooley is a fine coach, and it's very, very reasonable to think he can resuscitate the program. I mean, I really believe that. Nobody goes to their games. They're playing downtown in a model that Dave Gavitt came up with 35 years ago that was brilliant at the time and may not be brilliant now. 2,000 people go to their games. Like, that school and all of its supporters have given up, right?
Well, there's that factor too, Tony, but I would say that you're right about the model. You know, okay, so when you lose, people don't go. That's a fact of life. But, you know, you're talking about a logistical nightmare. If you're a student and you need to get, you want to come downtown, it's not, you have no metro out at Georgetown. Mm-hmm. It's just not, you don't walk across campus and go to the game. You've got to make a very concerted effort to get there. You also don't have a student body that is 30,000 strong like a big state school would be. You don't have a centralized alumni base because, you know, Georgetown is a very elite academic school whose graduates don't all just stick around in the place they grew up. They scatter around the globe. So to fill a 20,000 seat arena, I mean, put it this way, there's a reason that Cameron Indoor Stadium is 9,300 seats and will always be 9,300 seats because that alumni base, which is also scattered, couldn't fill 20,000 seats on
a nightly
basis. It's a small school. Wake Forest doesn't have a 20,000 seat arena. So that is a bad fit. But I think if Ed Cooley can get it to start feeling, you know, that the arena's half full, not half empty, then he'll be have it pointed in the right direction.
Kelleher, of course, is a Georgetown graduate and always tells this story that when a friend wanted to bust his chops, he hadn't seen him in a while. He said, Georgetown, is that a four-year school yet? That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. All right. How about Notre Dame giving Micah Shrewsbury 7 years? Who were they bidding against that they had to go to 7 years? Doesn't that seem like a lot?
It's a lot, but I also think that the buzz around that guy became very intense, and especially for a job based in the Midwest. He was a longtime assistant to Brad Stevens at Butler during the glory years, and then went with Stevens to the Celtics. And my friend and colleague Adam Kilgore did a story on him last week, and you know, it's one of those things where you start calling around on a guy and you can tell how well respected they are by how quickly people call you back. And like Brad Stevens was on the horn in like 5 seconds saying like, you know, this guy, how he waited that long to get a job like Penn State, I have no idea. And then Notre Dame, the consensus was, you know, he has all these ties to Indiana and the Midwest. And it was just, you know, if it's not the Hoosiers' job, that the Notre Dame job is a perfect job for him. So 7 years is a long time, but I was surprised over the last month how much just general positiveness there was around him, and kind of this is way too late for him to have gotten an opportunity at such a good place.
So these are three big Catholic schools that we're talking about. One is Georgetown, one is Notre Dame, and now we have to talk about St. John's. And Rick Pitino carries a lot of baggage. He also carries rings, championship rings from two different schools that nobody has ever done. He took three different schools to the Final Four, and he's going to be given whatever he needs at St. John's, because there's Wall Street money at St. John's, right? You would not be surprised at all if in 2 to 3 years he was in the Final Four, would you?
No, not because it doesn't take long to build a program. You can get experienced good players very quickly because you don't have to sit out transferring now. And he knows where everybody. He knows where all the players are. He knows how to talk up what St. John's was. I think St. John's played only four games at Madison Square Garden last year.
Well, they had alumni hall most of the time, probably, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that Pitino will look at the schedule and say, like, yeah, we'll play two on campus and we'll play 18 at downtown, thank you.
That's right.
And his name, his swagger, his accomplishments, yeah, the baggage is certainly a thing and you have to acknowledge it. But for that job at that time, they are a version of what Georgetown was, a shell of their former self. They tried the Ewing route with Chris Mullin, and he lasted even less time than Ewing did. That couldn't be more of a perfect fit in terms of, I mean, he will win. That I would say Ed Cooley standing there saying we will win a national championship seems like absolute hyperbole. If Rick Pitino stands in New York at St. John's and says we will win here, that is spoken truth, I think.
Totally
very
believe that. You've been running around lately, obviously, with the NCAAs and Nats camp. You went to Nats camp. What's the mood around Nats camp?
Well, I was there before one of the young pitchers, Cade Cavalli.
It's out. Tommy John, see ya.
So there's my philosophy, Tony, this year was if there's a reason to turn on the television you know, once every five nights because you're interested in the pitcher, then that's good. And I thought that three out of the five nights when it was Mackenzie Gore, Cade Cavalli, and Josiah Gray, you might accomplish that. So there goes, you know, a fifth of that theory. I do think they're generally
not going to tune in to see when Patrick Corbin gives up his first home run. You're not going to do that, huh?
I mean, you better set your alarm because it could be early, right? The other thing I would say, Tony, the takeaway from spring, and I don't know how much you've talked about this, but like baseball is a different sport than it was last October. The pitch clock has.
I haven't seen it. I want to see it in real, you know, in a real season. I want to see it.
It's unbelievable. The average spring training game a year ago was 3 hours. The average spring training game this year is 2 hours and 36 minutes. It is such a positive change because it cuts out nothing that you would miss. Guys like going to the rosin bags, batters stepping out. And, you know, if the beer cutoff is in the seventh inning, well, it's a lot earlier now because the seventh inning is on you before you know it. It's a fundamental change.
I'll get you out of here on this one question. It concerns me. Do you think the Nats will be sold this year?
I don't think they'll be sold. I mean, if this year means this season, I don't think they will. We are waiting to hear on a court decision in New York about revenue from
the TV,
from Masson. And that could give some clarity to Ted Leonsis, who's interested in purchasing the team, about what he can expect from the Nationals' media rights. That's so in the weeds, but it's also so important. There is not a long list of people still in the bidding. It feels like Leonsis or bust. I do think that when you get out of the season, which will probably be another 100-loss season, you need clarity pretty fast because the general manager has a contract that runs through this year. The manager has a contract that runs through this year. They have assembled the beginnings of a core that could be, you know, what their core was when they were winning all the time. But they need to have direction. Can we pursue the equivalent of a Jason Worth for 7 years going forward? What can we do in terms of extensions for the players that we have here? There's so much on pause because of the ownership situation. I would hope that by October or November, we either know, yes, they're they're full on going to sell the thing, or no, they're retrenching and trying to go forward, and the Lerner families would stay on board.
I enjoyed watching the World Baseball Classic, but every so time fun. Turner and Schwarber hit it out, I just said, my God, we could have had them. We had them. So.
Had them.
Thanks, Barry.
Appreciate it, Tony. Thanks.
Barry Zwierluga, boys and girls. That's a great column, by the way, in the Washington Post. For those of you, I always sort of think that I'm talking to people who live around the corner, but I realize I'm not. We'll take a break. Steve Sands is at the Match Play Classic in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas.
You know, got to ask him, why is it in Austin, Texas?
Well, it won't be for much longer.
What happened?
I think the members overplayed their hands and wanted a few upgrades to the facility, but I'm not sure exactly what happened.
I'll ask about it. Sands, when we return, I'm Tony Kornheiser.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Once again, this is Sidney Cruz. This is called Prisoner. You can listen to Sidney Cruz and not have to listen to me talking over her at the end of the show. In fact, if you had any brains, you would just do it now. Let's go listen to Sidney Cruz and Prisoner. Why do people's dads have to send us their music? You know, why does that happen?
She's great. This is fantastic. Sidney Cruz. Sidney.
The dog is barking because I think that we have ants in the house, and we got the American pest people to come. So could somebody find out if Carol's
ants?
Awake?
Aunt Joni?
Not Aunt Joni.
The ants are here.
Aunt Joni here.
He's slouching.
Steve Sands joins us now. Michael just read me a couple of quotes from Rory McIlroy. I'm going to get to them really quickly, but I need to ask you this. This is the match play event that you're at. This is a sort of a weird event. Can you explain what it is, and can you tell me if players actually like it?
Well, it's different in that match play, usually you get a winner and a loser each day, and then you survive in advance, kind of like March Madness in the NCAA tournament. On the PGA Tour, they decided years ago to switch the format to Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday is group play. So today, of those 16 groups of four players, only one player will get out of that group.
Right.
So today is truly the match play that you're familiar with at Columbia or with your friends or
right.
wherever you play, as opposed to stroke play. So it turns into match play today for all the matches where people are still alive and can advance.
I like watching golf, and sometimes I remember, and may not be true anymore, that this was a 36-hole final, and Kevin Kisner always won it, and I just said, what am I doing here? You know, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, Kevin's been in the final three times. He won it once. He was a runner-up twice. Look, some people are built for match play versus stroke play. Some people don't love it. I don't know how you wouldn't love it. Match play to me is so exciting compared to stroke play. You can't do it every week,
right?
But again, today when you start eliminating people, and then tomorrow especially when it gets to the round of 16, it's just regular in quotations regular match play. You know, win or go home. Kisner's he's still alive. He's one of those tough guys, man. He is a tough guy to get out of this thing, but. He's not as tough as Scottie Scheffler, Tony. My gosh, he's doing it again. He's amazing.
Scottie Scheffler's big, too, isn't he?
He's a big guy.
Yeah, he looks like he could have played anything, and he decided at a very early age to play this. So I will tell you that I am interested because I know some members of the family in Denny McCarthy, who is a local for us, and he went to Virginia, right, Michael? Went to Virginia. He's been on a tour for a while. I don't think he has won yet, and we sort of... You know, how could he get into the Masters? Well, he'd had to get out of his group and this, that, and the other thing. And then, you know, we had this unfortunate thing on the first day where he's way up on Keegan Bradley. And I think Keegan Bradley birdies the last three holes to have something like that. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, he birdies four of his last five.
Yeah, and you should never lose that lead. You shouldn't. But then yesterday he plays Rory. And can you describe what Rory hit on the last hole?
I genuinely think it's the greatest drive I've ever seen anybody hit. Now, you have to contextualize it a little bit. Is it the final round of a major? Is it, 16th, 17th, or 18th hole at a major championship when you need it? You can think of a lot of drives over the years. Dustin Johnson at Kapalua, came to mind, but that's Kapalua, and it's different type of golf course. Different circumstance as well. Angel Cabrera had a great drive at the 18th
at Oakmont,
which I thought was the greatest drive I've ever seen under those circumstances. So I'll still take Angel Cabrera. But the guys I was working with yesterday in the booth said they've never seen a drive better. The tour average, okay, the PGA, these are the best players on the planet, Tony. The PGA Tour average carry, that means carry in the air, for a drive is 281 yards. Okay? 281 yards. That's a long, long ways for a carry. Not the bounce, the carry.
Just where it lands. First hits the ground.
Yesterday on the 18th hole, Rory McIlroy hit a bullet and it went 349 in the air.
188 ball speed.
Landed on the front edge of the green and ended up less than 4 feet from the hole. He never even putted for two. Because he didn't have to, and McIlroy won the match. And I think it's the greatest drive I've ever seen, just because of the distance and the control and the accuracy. Circumstances dictate, I would say, that Angel Cabrera at Oakmont and the U.S. Open was better, but what McIlroy did yesterday was literally astonishing to see it in person. It was amazing.
So let me go over this. How long is this hole?
Well, he carried it 349. It's a short par four.
But it's...
He carried it 349 to the front edge of the green. So the front edge of the green, let's say, is 348.
Right.
And he carried it 349. Yesterday, the hole was back left. So let's say the hole was probably 365.
So you're standing at the tee.
He hit it 360, and he hit it 367 and a half. Huh. It was amazing. At the hole, by the way, it was spectacular.
You're standing on the tee. It says, when you look at the marker, 365 yards.
Exactly.
365. If you're me, that's three shots. Okay. I mean, if you're a good player, it's two shots. But right. It's two shots. And the second shot, even if you're a good player, is going to be 80 to 100 yards, right? If you're a good player, 80 to 100, maybe 60 to 80. Yeah. And he put it 4 feet from the hole. Now, if you're Denny McCarthy playing against him, you tip your hat, right? I mean, what do you do, right?
Well, here's what's crazy, Tony, is that the guys can't see the green from the tee. So McIlroy had the honor. He took driver, and he landed it on the green, and it rolled up there to about 4 feet. So he flies at 349 and gets it up there to about 4 feet. And he thinks he's hit a nice drive. He's hit a straight drive. He's hit a nice towering drive. But he has no idea where it's landed or where it's ended up. There aren't massive crowds at that point of the day because on the 18th hole, there are fewer fans in match play than there would be.
Because it doesn't get there most of the time.
Exactly.
Right.
15, 16, 17 is where the matches usually end. That's where usually where all the huge crowds are. But anyway, so it wasn't like some massive roar. So I'm in the booth. And we're like, we're just wowed by the entire thing. Smiley Kaufman, who used to play on tour, was a winner on tour, is the walker for us yesterday. McIlroy walks off the tee and says to Smiley, as they were going to commercial, hey, where did that end up? And Smiley tells him, Smiley played on the PGA Tour. He won a PGA Tour event. He has a tremendous golfer. He says to Rory, it landed on the front edge. And Rory was just like, get out of here. He's like, He's like, literally, get out of here. And he goes, no, it landed on the front edge. It's about 4 feet away. And Rory just started laughing. So when he and Denny started walking and got up to the top of the hill and saw Rory's drive, I mean, Denny just shook his head and Rory, just started giggling even louder.
He's the best driver in golf. I want to stress this because a lot of times you look at athletes and physically, they are very different than you. Rory McIlroy is about 5'10 or 5'11. I mean, he's pumped up, but he's 5'10 or 5'11, and he kills it. He's not 6'5". He's not big like Rahm is big, not big like Ernie Els was big. He's normal, and he kills it. How does that happen?
He might be 5'10 or 5'11 in the program, but he's not 5'10 or 5'11 when you're measuring him. He's probably about 5'9, maybe even 5'8. I mean, his clubhead speed, was that Michael who said 188,
yep.
189 clubhead speed? I mean, ball speed, clubhead speed, the amount of energy that goes through that golf swing is amazing. His stature is not big. He is not a big guy at all. I know he's fit, but he is not a big guy at all. I bet you he weighs 150 pounds. It's amazing. I mean, I right before the drive, sometimes this happens in TV and you just get really lucky, Tony. You know this. But just before the drive, when we have all that time, there 32 matches, they were all done except for those two. So they were the only guys on the golf course. At the time, so we had plenty of time to chat. Normally, we're just going shot to shot to shot. And literally, I said to Brad Faxon on the air, I said, you know, he's probably the best, if not the second or third, maybe the second or third best driver of the golf ball of his generation. Let's see what happens here. And then he drills it like that. It was pretty wild, man. I wish it was a Sunday at a tour event. And there were, you know, 12,000 people on that hole. The place would have gone absolutely bananas. But as far as I'm concerned, it's as good a drive as you'll ever see anywhere, anytime.
Rory said the other day that he wants to win majors. He will be judged by winning majors. And he said if they put in the restricted flight ball and they put it in at majors, he's happy to use it on the PGA Tour, even if some people think that may be a disadvantage if there's a local rule that you don't have to. He wants to do it. Because if it's in the majors, he wants to win majors. What do you think of that?
You know, he's on an island there, Tony. Almost every other player I can think of, maybe every player at the highest level of the PGA Tour, does not like the idea of rolling the golf ball back. I think McIlroy, I've said this to you before, he's very thoughtful, a smart guy. And he's not trying to buck a trend or be a contrarian or anything like that. He truly thinks that this is going to be the best thing for golf, and so does the USGA and the RNA, the two entities who make the rules. I think Rory is definitely going to be measured by the major championships. He's 33 years of age, Tony. He hasn't won a major in 9 years.
Yeah,
the 2014 PGA Championship, he won that congressional in 2011, and then he won his fourth in 2014. So he won four majors in a four-year span. As far as years go, calendar years, and he hasn't won one since. And let's face it, in 2 weeks, when we chat again on your show, Tony, and we're going to be talking about Rory McIlroy winning the Masters again. This is his 10th opportunity or 9th opportunity to win the career Grand Slam. So rolling back the ball is something that you'd have to get really into the weeds for your audience as far as whether it's good or bad. The guys at the highest level can't stand it. The equipment people can't stand it. The Titleist, the Callaways, you know, the TaylorMades, the companies that make golf balls, they can't stand it. Nobody wants to bifurcate, meaning one of the beauties of golf is that you and Michael go play with friends at Columbia and you're doing the exact same thing with the exact same equipment on the exact same type of rules that PGA Tour players play by. And nobody wants to split that up. The PGA Tour definitely does not, but the PGA Tour and the PGA Tour players, you know, and the equipment companies have to look after themselves in this regard. It'll be really interesting to see how this all plays out. It hasn't been completed yet, Tony.
Right.
It just has been recommended by the USGA and the RNA. So I don't think this argument is going to be even close to being done before this is implemented or if it's even tweaked a little bit by 2026.
Wow, that's a long time off. Thank you. Enjoy yourself in Austin, Texas. Thank you.
You'll still be playing golf in 2026, Tony.
I sure hope so. Yeah,
absolutely.
I hope so. Steve Sands, boys and girls. We will take a break. We will come back with email and jingle. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
In celebration of opening day, we've got a special episode of the Moth Podcast for you. The theme is baseball and the surprising ways it connects people.
I gaze out at the players on the field, and then I look over at my dad, and I realize that in the silence between us that something has changed. It's like I'm seeing him for the first time.
Two stories about baseball, family, and so much more. The episode's available right now. Subscribe to the Moth Podcast to make sure you hear it.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes Tony's mailbag. Got your email, faxes, and your notes. Here comes Tony's mailbag. Gonna read some for all of you folks.
Thank you, Cajun. You want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad?
Yes, Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area nearest you, then pop on in, and you will be thrilled.
Before we get to the mailbag, let me just say, well, it's been building up inside of me for, oh, I don't know how long. I don't know why, but I keep thinking something's bound to go wrong. But she looks in my eyes and makes me realize when she says, don't worry, baby. That's my favorite song of all time, Don't Worry, Baby. The second verse is something like, I know I should have kept my mouth shut when I'd start to brag about my car, but I can't back down now because I pushed the other guys too far. something, and it says, and makes me want to drive when she says, don't worry, baby. It's 1963 or 1964. I don't know which year. It's my favorite song of all time. Really is. Thanks to our guests today. Steve Sands, Barry's Verluga. Thanks to our sponsors, Priceline and Sunday. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review.
So one of my music streaming services basically sends me a personalized playlist that's based on some of my listening habits. And I would just love it to curate something based on the songs that you talk about, because I always leave here thinking, I want to now listen to some more Simon and Garfunkel songs and add Don't Worry Baby, Do It. So,
well, yeah, again, I mean, what the Beach Boys had that other people didn't have was that genetic component to allow them to sing in a certain kind of harmony that you don't hear other places.
If only I had three boys who could maybe, I don't know.
Well, you could do
get
that.
The band
don't
together.
Don't you sing to the captain every night?
Every night.
So maybe the captain will pick that up and have a great
running
voice.
Running to Stand Still and then Hallelujah.
You know, I mean, that was lovely. Oh, you sing Hallelujah, Leonard
every
Cohen
night,
song?
And every night he gets to choose if he wants me to sing it. I've heard there was a secret chord that, and recently...
Wait, he gets to choose. He's not even one. He doesn't
no,
talk.
No, this is for the hammer.
Oh,
the captain
okay, the
just
hammer.
Gets sung too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Henry, oh, so the hammer sings with you.
No, he gets to choose if I'm singing it to that Henry Hurd or that Walker Hurd.
Oh, okay.
Those are their real names.
All right.
ER names.
Yeah. From Joe Pearson in Indianapolis. Okay, so all this talk about Rivian made me visit their website.
I saw the truck.
Oh, you did?
Outside the elementary
school, I suppose.
Wow.
Sure, 0 to 60 in 3 seconds sounds impressive, but they list the vehicle's wading depth, WADING, wading depth at 3+ feet. 3+ feet. Forget all those police warnings about not entering flooded streets, baby. I've got a Rivian.
You're talking about a duck boat.
You know. From Rupesh, the Sharma in Lebanon, Ohio.
Whatever, Rupesh.
Don't we call him Rup?
Rup.
Aren't we supposed to call him Rup?
I believe
My
we
brother-in-law
are.
Is Rup, an engineer is. For Rivian. I'm happy to get you answers to any questions you have. Here's the question I have. When can it be here? And what is the discount? Okay. Mike from Arnold. My day started off yesterday pretty eventfully with a woman to whom I'm related by marriage going into labor at 4:30 a.m. This would be our second child, so I was told to expect a somewhat faster labor than the 24 hours our first required. Is that true?
Yes, but now the biggest question is, that's going to labor overnight like that. Who's watching the big kid?
I thought it was pretty nice that we would have a child born on the vernal equinox and start out their life on the first day of spring.
Sure.
However, things didn't move along quite as expected, and I realized we were going well past 3:20. I immediately realized our new baby would have the birth date of 3/21/23. You can't beat that numerology. Yeah, it's a palindrome. Didn't want to seem too gleeful, as I was not the one enduring
the
labor
clock.
Pains.
Yeah.
So I kept it to myself.
Slow it down.
I am happy to announce the birth of the newest little, my second non-masculine child, Zoe Day McIntarget, at 4/27 or 3/21/23. Big shout out to the labor and delivery nurses at Arundel Medical Center. You carried my family through what could have been a very difficult day. I'm eternally grateful. From Tom Opelt in Colorado Springs, Colorado. You are cordially invited to my wedding to the lovely Miss Brett on Tuesday, March 21st, 2023, 3/21/23. While not quite one in a million, ours is an unlikely story. 11 years ago, we were among a group of friends who attended weekly pub trivia every Thursday. As time went by, we grew apart and she moved away. 4 years later in 2019, I was enjoying quiz at a different bar in town on Valentine's Day. Suddenly she approached and surprised me with a Valentine's card. I had no idea she was back in town and she had recognized me. We began a friendly rivalry between our two trivia teams and occasionally joined each other. A year later, we started dating. We've been engaged over a year and decided 3/21/23 would be a nice and memorable anniversary. Yeah, that's sort of like 11/11/22, which is in my life. We plan on having our first child on 2/29/24. I hear it's pretty easy to pick a date for that, right?
Yeah.
Circle it.
It's lovely. From Barney. Attached is a save the date. Please join the woman I am not yet married to as we trip the light fantastic. I thought it was trip the night fantastic. Maybe it's the light. I got tired of waiting for my funeral to listen to the Nighthawks, so they are playing Friday night for the rehearsal dinner. You, however, still on to open up my funeral. Someday I'm sure you will talk with Jim Boeheim again. When you do, please ask him about the coaching job at Syracuse. Yes, before he replaced Roy Danforth as the basketball coach, he was the golf coach. Did they use orange balls in the snow? When you discuss the possibility of the Nats setting a record for the greatest last to first season ever, well, I am a homer. Ask Tim Kurkjian why, when he played basketball at WJ for 25 years on Thursday nights, with the game on the line, he would pass to the worst shooter on the court, me. Barney Shapiro with a long Shapiro for the long, the retired former actually paid trash man to the Tony Kornheiser show. Well, to chat. Yeah, they did trash. Yeah, that was great. Oh, it's a save the date. Good for him. Good for him. One in a million. In my senior year at Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey, I tutored in math to earn some extra money since I'd gotten married that summer. Most were on-campus students, but one was older and lived an hour away in North Jersey. We agreed to meet on Saturdays at his mother-in-law's place, which is about halfway between us. One time he was late, so I had coffee with his mother-in-law. She mentioned she grew up in Jersey City. I mentioned that the father of the woman I was then related to by marriage had also grown up in Jersey City. She asked his name. I told her. Then she asked, "Does he have a sister named Phyllis?" I said, "Yes." "Did she marry a man named Nick?" Again, I said, "Yes." Then she said, "I dated Nick before he married Phyllis." Okay. From Andrew Herman. "I'm not a numbers guy. Rather, I'm a lawyer who briefly worked for the incomparable Abby Lowell. But I'm pretty sure that the ABCD birthday calculations are wrong. According to math, or maths, as Nigel would say,
the
birthday paradox reveals that in a random group of 23 golfers, there's about a 50-50 chance that two of them will share a birthday. Don't ask me to show my work. I don't know the total number of golfers in the pool, but with 60, the chances of two sharing a birthday is close to 100%. Like I said, I'm no math expert, but it seems like the odds of four people sharing a birthday in one group is small, but it is not astronomical." From Gary Pitts in Knoxville, Tennessee. "On Wednesday's episode, you read an email from Tony Ann Maynard in which she invited you and Michael to join her husband and son for a round of golf at the Burlington Country Club. You should go. I don't know the Maynards, nor do I have any connection to the Burlington Country Club, but I did drive through Vermont once, at which point I discovered Burlington is home to the world's tallest filing cabinet. See the attached photo. If the post is not already taken, can I be the official guy who took a selfie in front of the world's tallest filing cabinet? Gary Pitts, Knoxville, Tennessee. P.S. It's not that tall." By the way, Michael, I think the town that we played golf in was Shrewsbury.
I'll look it up.
You know, all the way up in the northern border.
Again, I remember that first hole where I cranked it left, never found it.
Is that called the Northern Neck?
From Kevin, I don't know, from Kevin Balo, rhymes with Halo, from Grove City, Ohio. "Chuck Culpepper and his colleagues were right that the tournament games in Columbus had the best stories. Therefore, I am certain he looked into the most important story in all of Central Ohio. Can you find out when he is running his column on the Africa Road construction in Galena?"
Yeah, that's a big one.
And from Steve Tabor in Fort Smith, Arkansas. "Thought you should know I traded in my Subaru for a different make. After the purchase, I was asked to complete a survey about my purchase experience. One of the questions was, when did you decide to trade vehicles at this time? Why did you decide to trade vehicles at this time? I wrote to get Tony Kornheiser off my back. Are we good now?" If you're out on your bike tonight, everybody, as always, do wear white.
Yeah, here's the thing. We're not the wonders right now.
There's our
Geach and the Shrimp Shack Shooters.
Have you ever thought when you're driving down the street, each person in each car is a